So tonight, the title of the talk this evening is Gratitude and Joy, the Holiday Spirit. I'd like to just start a little bit, just flavor and mood some of the words of the Buddha. This is on the development of loving kindness. Monks, whatever grounds there are for making merit productive of a future birth, all these do not equal a 16th part of the liberation of the mind by loving kindness. The liberation of mind by loving kindness surpasses them and shines forth bright and brilliant. Just as the radiance of all the stars does not equal a 16th part of the moon's radiance, but the moon's radiance surpasses them and shines forth bright and brilliant. Even so, whatever grounds there are for making merit productive of a future birth, all these do not equal a 16th part of the liberation of mind by loving kindness. The liberation of mind by loving kindness surpasses them and shines forth bright and brilliant. Just as in the last month of the rainy season in the autumn, when the sky is clear and free of clouds, the sun on ascending dispels the darkness of space and shines forth bright and brilliant. Even so, whatever grounds there are for making merit productive of a future birth, these do not equal a 16th part of the liberation of mind by loving kindness. The liberation of mind by loving kindness surpasses them and shines forth bright and brilliant. And just as in the night, at the moment of dawn, the morning star shines forth bright and brilliant. Even so, whatever grounds there are for making merit productive of a future birth, all these do not equal a 16th part of the liberation of mind by loving kindness. The liberation of mind by loving kindness surpasses them and shines forth bright and brilliant. It's particularly helpful to read those cheerful words of brightness and brilliance in these dark, dark nights, the long dark night, the dark rainy times that we're in. I don't know, some of you may have the seasonal affect disorder. I know that some years I have to deal with that. When I lived in California, I didn't have it at all, but here it's another story. So to reflect and read things that will bring up that sense of inner light, will encourage us, give us confidence in the practices that we do, that they can bring us light, joy, rejoicing, faith. It's very helpful, very supportive, I think. And this window of holidays where we start with Thanksgiving and then we go on to, you know, celebration of solstice and Christmas, Kwanzaa, Hanukkah. There's also in there in the Japanese Soto Zen tradition, Bodhi Day. We just had Bodhi Day, December 8th, which is also, I think, the Annunciation in the Catholic. Does anybody know? Something like that. We have Feast of Guadalupe. We have Boxing Day in Canada. There's then, of course, New Year's Eve, New Year's Day. So we have this series of joyful holidays. We begin with Thanksgiving, and then we move into this time of joy, rejoicing, bringing back the light. I was thinking also, unfortunately, this year it also included the end of the world because of the... the Mayan calendar, on December 21st. But then I was delighted to hear that that actually was a misinterpretation, and it's actually, it's the reset point for the Mayan calendar. So it just a sense that it resets December 21st this year, which then it seemed quite delightful to think about, well, hey, possibly I could reset. You know, I invite us all to reset December 21st. Why not? A very nice, very good idea, and aligned with our practice of letting go, beginning again, beginning fresh. We could also reset. So we have the Thanksgiving holiday, and one of the Dharma leaders here, I looked at it, did a Thanksgiving, nice before Thanksgiving, a nice talk focusing on gratitude, as particularly as an expression of the awakened heart. Tim, I think, did that. So I recommend that one to you. It's very good. And also, there is a, Philip Moffat was here recently. He wrote a very, very excellent article on selfless gratitude. It's on his website. I think if you Google around, you'll find it. So we have this reflections on gratitude. What I'll speak about this evening will complement that, because the other side of working with gratitude is gratitude as it relates to the practice of mudita, appreciative joy, sympathetic joy, the ability to rejoice in the good fortune of others, which again, part of the teachings, the Brahmaviharas, so that this quote that we had on the light of loving kindness can certainly be considered, can be included, mudita also, this joy and rejoicing. And the cultivation of that, and how, as I did in the guided meditation, when you bring that energy of mudita within, I mean, we can also, of course, when we have moments where we have success or happiness, we can wish to ourselves, may my happiness continue, may joy never leave me. But actually, it's more in the flavor of that particular energy of mudita, that when it's within, when we're focusing on ourselves, we activate, focus on, reflect on happy gratitude, that feeling of gratitude. And as I tried to design in the guided meditation, when we actually feel the flavor of that, it does feel very much, very similar to joy. So, and of course, that's the happy gratitude. You know, we, again, in the West, we have to deal with our conditioning, our programming, where we're often given that kind of scolding, I call the grumpy gratitude, or you ought to be thankful, give thanks, and what are you thankful for, what are you grateful for, that kind of thing. So that, when we say the word thanks, thanksgiving, gratitude, for us that can also often come in as a bit of a coloring. So we want to shift away and realize that the gratitude related to this practice is a happy gratitude. And when we feel that in our bodies and our hearts, it has this flavor of joy, and there's just this spontaneous thank you, thank you. Delight, there's a delight there, so that we, again, see this connection of gratitude and joy. There's a Catholic brother, Brother David Stendhal Rastin. Many, many years ago, he wrote a book called Gratefulness, the Heart of Prayer. He's also a very, very long-standing, decades-standing Zen practitioner. He was on the board of San Francisco Zen Center for years, many years ago. So he speaks in that book, and it's the first time that I read and thought about that, that he mentions that people who are very grateful are also very joyful, and people on the outside looking at that assume that they are so grateful because there is so much joy in their lives. As we look from the outside, we think that might be the case. But actually, it's the reverse. That because they practice so much gratitude, their experience just keeps manifesting more and more joy. So that's a very interesting thing, but it lines up very much with our teachings on mudita as well. This connection between happy practice of happy gratitude and joy. So again, thinking of this holiday time, getting in the flavor of sort of taking from our experience of our calendar, this flavor of the holidays, we can see that we begin in our calendar year, regardless of the history, where these holidays came from, it's sort of, you know, whatever. I was born in 1949, actually. So, you know, the history, these things were in place long before I was born. So just kind of showing up in the moment of our experience, we say, calendar here. If we're Mayan, maybe end of the world, but not, just reset, so that's good. But so here in the West, we have Thanksgiving, so an opportunity to practice gratitude, happy gratitude. And then this sequence of other holidays coming up in December, Bodhi Day, again, Japanese Zen, you can celebrate enlightenment. And then all of these other brightening of the light, coming back of the light, giving of gifts, these kinds of celebrations. So opportunities then to move from happy gratitude to appreciative joy, rejoicing, the opportunity for rejoicing. I rejoice, Ajahn Brahm, a wonderful teacher from the Thai forest tradition, Ajahn Chah was his teacher. I have a particular rejoicing. He a wonderful teacher, and he is also a great defender of the women's issues. he, in the ordination of women, full ordination as Theravada nuns and so forth, he actually got himself excommunicated for a while. I think they've re-communicated him or whatever you would say. I don't know. But really speaking, standing up for the women and for full ordination. So again, in the Tibetan tradition, there's this aspect of rejoicing in the goodness of others, rejoicing in the goodness that others do. So instead of when others are doing some goodness, we might have the tendency to think, oh, that should be me, why am I not doing that? Oh, they're so much better than I am. All of those kinds of comparing can come up. But if we take this onto our path of practice, then really the response is to rejoice in that goodness. And of course, one example is given that even if you're sick and you can't go out and do anything, you can spend your time when you're ill rejoicing in the goodness of others, and that that has a power. It's in the context of practicing the Brahmaviharas. Is a very powerful act of mind and heart. So we can begin to make that a technique for ourselves and begin a habit of shifting from that habit of self-criticism, comparing, demeaning, feeling less than, and so forth. And instead, whenever we hear of any goodness done, we can have a moment or a few moments of rejoicing in that goodness. The goodness of others, the benefit that others do. We have here a wonderful thing that was explained to me when I was here early. You have our cards that are gift cards for the holidays that are being sold for the benefit of the homeless, and this particular facility takes care of women staying overnight. And so that when I was told about that, it just this feeling of rejoicing again in the heart, like how wonderful that that's done and how wonderful this Sangha takes part in that. Of course, again, there's so many. You look at your bulletin board there and all the activities. And again, there is this lovely feeling of, for me, of rejoicing in what's done by this community and what Rodney and all of his senior and the students and now all of the others here have made in Seattle, this wonderful Dharma community with all kinds of things going on, very, very rich, and rejoicing in the goodness of that. Again, really a part of this cultivation of mudita, the energy of mudita, which has this appreciative joy and also this happy gratitude flavor and feeling in the body, the mind, the heart. Ajahn Brahm has sort of re-articulated the Four Noble Truths in some contexts. He does this, and he rearranges them, and he mentions this as this book of stories, of Dharma stories. This is quite lovely if you haven't heard him do this. So, Four Noble Truths rearranged. One, happiness. Two, the cause of happiness. Three, the absence of happiness. Four, the cause for such an absence. Quite lovely, huh? Suddenly get another flavor on the Four Noble Truths, that we can also look at it in this light. And there is this flavor of rejoicing, of joy, as this instruction, the way the list of instructions. The Dalai Lama also speaks of the Four Noble Truths in this way. And again, when he talks about in his ethics for the new millennium, he talks about using as an ethic for the whole world, all beings wish happiness. And then developing a way of looking at behavior in the world so that we can see our behavior as that it's, pursuit and actualization of our happiness, pursuit and actualization of the happiness of others, and avoiding that which would take away others' happiness. And using that as the beginning of a whole view of ethics. Very lovely, again, very, very bright feeling with that, the light in this path, the light in the Dharma. I remember when this recently, the hurricane, Hurricane Sandy, and all of which is going to be being dealt with, all the distress and pain for a long time. So various people in the Dharma sent out emails, little missives to their students, and Lama Tarchin, who is a Tibetan Lama from, we would say now, from the old country, because that generation of Tibetan teachers that were born in Tibet is aging out, but he's still with us, and somewhere in his 70s, very sweet, wonderful teacher Lama, comes to Nalanda West sometimes. So he sent out an email and offering advice for students, and particularly as the Tibetan tradition would do, particular prayers and mantras that would be helpful and useful. And then I saw that he very quickly, right away in the email, took a sentence or two to share that he himself was rejoicing in the goodness of all the people that were helping in various ways between the volunteering and donations and things like that. And then he invited his students as well to take a moment to do that, to rejoice in that goodness. And again, it was just for me to see this great accomplished Lama taking a moment to express that and to suggest that the students do that as a part of their Dharma practice, that the important part of their Dharma practice, just again that lovely reminder of this practice of rejoicing. There's a great book in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition that the Way of the Bodhisattva. You know, it's a book about training to be a bodhisattva. And Shanti Deva, the author of that, early on begins a portion with this practice of rejoicing. This is what he says in translation, of course. Gladly do I rejoice in the virtue that relieves the misery of all those in unfortunate states and that places those with suffering in happiness. I rejoice in that gathering of virtue that is the cause for the Arhat's awakening. I rejoice in the definite freedom of embodied creatures from the miseries of cyclic existence. I rejoice in the awakening of the Buddhas and also in the spiritual levels of their sons and daughters. And with gladness, I rejoice in the ocean of virtue from developing an awakening mind that wishes all beings to be happy, as well as in the deeds that bring all beings benefit. Very beautiful. Again, a prayer and a practice that this great teacher, very attentive to the details of the path of developing awakening, developing of compassion, takes this time to outline for us so that we can also experience this kind of rejoicing and making a point of doing that. So we can again think of this as a real wonderful aspect of our practice. As we look around, with the holidays, of course, there's all of the grumbling that we can do with very good reason about commercialism and that sort of thing, and not saying that that isn't a reflection, a powerful reflection. But then also we can turn another way as well and take the opportunity of rejoicing that there is so much goodness being done in the name of whatever, the name of whatever celebration, the name of whatever sense of bringing light into the world, a lot of goodness is being done. And then we can also, if we have children, if you're fortunate, you can see this joyful rejoicing situation in the various holidays. If we don't, we can remember maybe our favorite aspects of that. These are joyful feelings. The smaller people really give us an inspiration for that. I will never forget, I may have told you before, this young, maybe I'm guessing 16 month somehow, that age group, this little boy, pre-toddler, not pre-verbal, but very active. So four of us went into a restaurant and sitting down to eat just before, as we're going in and we're just kind of chatting to each other, this little boy, baby boy, sitting with his parents at the next table, just turned to us, shot out his arms in this incredible smile, and I don't know what language it was, just started babbling to us. Wasn't an language I speak. But I certainly, the emotion, and he just kind of, so as though he owned the restaurant somehow or something, inviting us in, or maybe, I don't know, reincarnation of Santa Claus. I don't know, the Buddha, who this little boy was. And just pure delight pure delight and joy and rejoicing at the sight of us. So we sat down and he kept doing that throughout the meal. Just every now and then he would turn over to us and just giggle and wave his arms and this incredible energy. And I leaned over to his mother and, you know, sort of like, what's up with this kid, you know? What is this? And she says, he's been like that since the moment he was born. Just incredible, pure delight. And so we see that there's something in this heart of us as human beings that just can shine forth with this bright, bright, beautiful light. And so again, we can remember when we want to activate, you know, in the guided meditation, I suggest, you know, babies and puppies, kittens. Some people get a little bit of flack about that sometimes. People think maybe I'm not treating this energy as profoundly as it by rights should be treated. But actually, in the guided meditation, I'm trying to help us move somewhere to so that we actually feel the feeling. So it moves out of the conceptual talk about it, and we're actually able to feel what this feeling is. And indeed, it is profound, but it's not conceptual, and it doesn't need to have a lot of discursive energy about it. So indeed, babies, that pure delight, the leaping of little puppies, kittens, that sort of thing, allows us to access this bright, bright energy of joy in our own hearts. So that's why I use those images. It has this quality of just pure delight. It's pure delight at life. In fact, that careful delight is something that sometimes we find it in poetry. That's why we enjoy poetry and we're inspired by poetry. This last year, 2012, this new collection by Mary Oliver was published, and someone gave me the book as a gift. So I want to share one or two of those with you tonight as well. This is called I Happen to Be Standing. I don't know where prayers go or what they do. Do cats pray while they sleep half asleep in the sun? Does the opossum pray as it crosses the street? The sunflowers, the old black oak growing older every year? I know I can walk through the world, along the shore or under the trees, with my mind filled with things of little importance, in full self-attendance, a condition I can't really call being alive. Is prayer a gift or a petition, or does it matter? The sunflowers blaze, maybe that's their way. Maybe the cats are sound asleep. Maybe not. While I was thinking this, I happened to be standing just outside my door with my notebook open, which is the way I begin every morning. Then a wren in the privet began to sing. He was positively drenched in enthusiasm. I don't know why, and yet, why not? I wouldn't persuade you from whatever you believe or whatever you don't. That's your business. But I thought of the wren singing What could this be if it isn't a prayer? So I just listened, my pen in the air. If we look carefully at the world, we see, we uncover this joy, this rejoicing, or it activates it within us. We could say that. And this appreciative joy, the joy at others' happiness, the joy at the world itself, the joy, light in the darkness. And then we begin to cultivate this kind of energy. Again, rejoicing, there are so many things. Again, we can reflect on the good activities of people in times of tragedy. We can reflect on the kinds of things that we hear about in our personal lives or, again, in the wider world. The Buddha talked about gladdening the heart as an important aspect of our practice. And if you think about long retreat, sometimes, boy, the energy just goes down, you know? And to have practices that will allow us to gladden the heart, brighten the energy. Again, sometimes quietly on retreat, in that kind of silence, we notice our comparing mind and we are convinced that everyone on the retreat is definitely doing somehow better than we are. Their practice is better, they're practicing more hours or whatever. Our energy can get kind of low and the thoughts that come can be quite glum. Or grim or something with G's in it and M's, I don't know. A feeling glue. And then we start to see that everyone else on the retreat, you know, better than us, making more progress and so forth. So then that can be a time when very, very skillful to turn the mind and the heart in this area of rejoicing, to reflect on this wonderful opportunity we have and the extraordinary, I know I've mentioned this before, the extraordinary thing that's going on in the West that we are a part of right now, which is all of these lay people intensively practicing the Dharma. Seriously, you know, I know this company in this room, it's quite extraordinary in the history of Buddhism. It just... reflecting on this history, quite an extraordinary time. And when we think about that we're part of that and a sense, a little bit of joyful gratitude, like how did this happen to us? And how fortunate we are. What, just again, an extraordinary moment in history that we're living through. Occasionally people will say, how did you ever get involved in this? And I will say, man, I don't know. You know, I was like 15 years old, a Catholic girl in the suburbs of Chicago in the early 60s. You tell me if that isn't proof of rebirth somehow. How did, you know, it just picking here and there. For me, one day I just asked my father. He had to drive me to the next town because there wasn't a bookstore in this tiny suburb we lived in because I wanted books on Buddhism and Taoism. How did that happen? How did we each... There's this wonderful rejoicing. And then in terms of a window in history, you know, because of... I'll give you this quick version. Because it was Rohatsu Sesshin Week, December 8th is Bodhi Day, Soto Zen, Japanese Soto Zen. So that week up to it, Japanese Soto Zen practitioners all over the world are meditating a week-long meditation, Rohatsu Sesshin, with this kind of fierce determination, you know, enlightenment or bust by Bodhi Day. And if you know Soto Zen, they can do fierce. And every night was the sitting doubles from the length of the evening sitting doubles from the night before till the last night. Some of the people, much younger than I, would be practicing all night long. It's just quite so. I got connected with that again years and years ago. You know, 40 years or something. I had experience in Soto Zen tradition, and thought about that and all of these folks all over the world. Sitting intensely and kind of a feeling of beaming in and then reflecting on Soto Zen, wonderful, wonderful tradition, and the founder of Soto Zen, really, Dogen, and his incredible writings. If you someday read some Dogen, and new translations coming out, Shobo Genzo, Kazutai Nahashi just did a last few years, finally published something, a translation I've been working on for ages. So tuning into all of that and then realizing Dogen, Japan, this is like early 13th century. He's like 1200, 1250, around that time. And he went to China and brought Zen, Chan, to Japan, and this was his mission, and translated everything that was in Chinese, Chan was in Chinese, into Japanese, and that also was part of his mission, so because he wanted the Japanese people to really be able to access the Dharma in this way. And then I thought, this is what's going on now. I'm living through this time where all of this Dharma, people translating into English for us and other modern languages for our sake. So people went to Asia and tasted the Dharma and then dedicated to bringing that back to us. This time, this window that we're living in will be in the history books, you know, a few hundred years from now. Extraordinary time. And then rejoicing in that, rejoicing and the gratitude to the translators, you know, what they've done for us so that we could do this. The gratitude of the people. We have a retreat center nearby, you know, Cloud Mountain. We're very lucky. There aren't folks, most folks have to fly in a plane, as Rodney just did, to get to another retreat center. But we just get in the car because D.D., Dhammadasa, built that by hand with some help over, you know, the last 20, 30 years, rejoicing in that goodness and a flavor of happy gratitude, rejoicing, delight. And for me, slightly stunned. You know, if you just take a step back and see what's happened to all of us, how fortunate we are, how extraordinary this is. So that energy of delight and rejoicing that can energize, as I say, in the difficult days of retreat practice, or in the difficult days of ordinary life as well. In all of this rambling around this past weeks, touching into some of the Soto Zen material, I came across a translation of a 20th century Japanese Zen poet's poem. Actually, Kaz translated it, the great. And now he did the recent translation of Shobo Genzo, Dogen Shobo Genzo, Kaz Tanahashi. A lot of the calligraphy you see, the Zen calligraphy, is Kaz. And I was, again, if you've either lived in a monastery ever or lived at a retreat center, this has no title. Looking for serenity, you have come to the monastery. Looking for serenity, I am leaving the monastery. Ha! Stop running about seeking. The dusty affairs of the world fill the day, fill the night. And of course, I just burst out laughing with delight. Again, if you've lived, this will happen, you know, at the retreat centers, as there are people crossing, and people come for serenity, and then you leave seeking serenity. So of course, the point here is maybe to stop running about seeking anything. Very much the heart of our Dharma practice. Just stop. Let it go. Be present. Be here. There is, of course, my main teachers in the Brahmaviharas intensive practice were Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg. And there are many things being written now, but there is still this great first book in English that was accessible to all of us, Loving Kindness, The Revolutionary Art of Happiness. I want to recommend to you, many of you I'm sure will have it at home in your bookshelf, go to chapter 8 and just reread chapter 8 again. It's called Liberating the Mind Through Sympathetic Joy, where she outlines the practice of sympathetic joy. If you haven't read it in a while, you might be a little surprised. You will think, wait a minute, that couldn't have been there. You know, I've read this book before, but somehow... So she, just a couple of things that she tells us. The root of the Pali word mudita means to be pleased, to have a sense of gladness. The Buddha called mudita the mind deliverance of gladness, because the force of happiness actually liberates us. Unlike a state of mere excitement or giddiness, the quality of sympathetic joy challenges our deep assumptions about aloneness, loss, and happiness, and shows us another possibility. It defeats many of the qualities of consciousness that bind us. And I'll just give you a taste. The qualities that bind us, that mudita, appreciative joy, the practice of rejoicing in the happiness and the good fortune and the success of others, will antidote these tormenting states of mind, all the different kinds of judgment, all the different kinds of comparing, all the kinds of prejudice, demeaning, the habit of demeaning, another kind of comparing. Mudita is non-demeaning, non-critical, non-judging. And of course, envy and jealousy. Mudita, rejoicing, antidotes that. Also, avarice and greed. Avarice is a real need to have, to keep, what others have, wanting what others have. So underneath that, there is an emptiness. Not the good kind. there is a sense of not enough. The practice of rejoicing, actually in the happiness of others, actually feeds us. It nourishes our heart. It fills our hearts. Again, think of the logic of this. If we only were to rejoice when good things happen to us, I don't know about you, but for me, there could be some lean weeks there, you know? But if you take up the practice of rejoicing when any other being has any success or happiness, think of how much fun you're going to have. It's amazing. It's really astounding. I so recommend it. It takes some time, if you're not used to it, to train in it and to learn to move out of things like, envy, jealousy, those comparing, judging, that sort of thing, and move to rejoicing. But it is so much fun. The opportunities are boundless. Again, it really redefines our sense of aloneness and loneliness when we can just look out in the world and rejoice at the happiness of others, because it's going on everywhere. Of course, We also respond to suffering with compassion. This isn't about, you know, kind of a Pollyanna just giggling joy at that, because the other Brahmaviharas, they all depend on each other. They all work with each other. You recently had Christina Feldman doing a whole series of non-residential retreat on the Brahmaviharas, and oh boy, you've got that video on your website. The richness of what her teaching on that material. I'll tell you, if anybody transcribed that and elaborated, it would be volumes. It's really amazing. So you can see, we can learn that these all work together, certainly loving kindness, compassion, equanimity. But this appreciative joy, this responding with rejoicing in the good fortune and the happiness of others, really tremendously nourishing for our hearts, tremendously healing, a real strong healing power. And then one of the things, and Sharon shares about this, that mudita, rejoicing, is the antidote for, is boredom. Boredom. Sharon says, the first time I read this claim, I wondered, how could sympathetic joy overcome boredom? I came to the conclusion that mudita eliminates boredom because it gives us so many reasons to feel happy and connected. Boredom is based on a sense of separateness and a turning away that we feel when we experience certain degrees of aversion. When we stop paying attention to the little things in life and the little things in our meditation practice as well, we find ourselves in a state of boredom. Again, mudita antidosis. This is also why we love many of the poets, because, you know, a poet is never bored. The definition of a poet is to be attentive to all the tiniest of things. Chapter 8. Your evening reading there. So, it's time to close. We have some announcements. I have a couple, and there's more. I have a lot more, but you could search out and enjoy. Here's Christina. Here's something Christina said to all y'all when she was here. What we dwell upon becomes the shape of our mind. And the shape of our mind will very frequently become the shape of our life. What we feed will grow. It's an eternal law. And what we are doing in the practice is nurturing the conditions in which joy can grow. So again, as we cultivate these various energies, Brahmaviharas, and particularly mudita, this ability to rejoice in so many different situations, we begin to dwell in that energy. And what we dwell upon becomes the shape of our mind. And the shape of our mind very frequently becomes the shape of our life. So these practices allow us to vary in the practices of the Brahmaviharas, loving kindness, compassion, and then particularly appreciative joy, allow us to intentionally dwell in that feeling, to learn how to feel it, and then to dwell there, so that that can become the shape of our mind, which then can become the shape of our lives. Nurturing the conditions in which joy can grow. So let's just for a moment sit, smiling, bringing to heart and mind your loving kindness benefactor, and then either someone that you love a lot who's in success or happiness, or just images, happy babies, puppies, kittens. And allow that feeling of rejoicing to come into your body, your heart, and your mind. And then with a flavor of rejoicing at the other's good fortune, we say, may your happiness continue. May all your successes continue. May joy never leave you. May joy never leave you. May joy never leave you. And to end with a poem, another poem from Mary Oliver. It's called Don't Hesitate. If you suddenly and unexpectedly feel joy, don't hesitate. Give into it. There are plenty of lives and whole towns destroyed or about to be. We are not wise and very often, and not very often, kind. And much can never be redeemed. Still, life has some possibility left. Perhaps this is its way of fighting back, that sometimes something happened better than all the riches and all the power in the world. It could be anything, but very likely you notice it in the instant when love begins. Anyway, that's often the case. Anyway, whatever it is, don't be afraid of its plenty. Joy is not made to be a crumb.